Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. I am delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Steve Horn, who is a Madison, Wisconsin-based writer for DSmog Blog. He is a contributing editor at Counterpunch and a contributing writer at Mint Press News and the producer of a seemingly endless volume of investigative reporting and blogging on issues that listeners to Talk Nation Radio clearly care about. Steve Horn, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So there's so many articles to choose from. One that came out just recently of yours is about censorship and a study of fracking. Can you talk about that?
Sure, yeah. So the very recently, what came out in the past couple of weeks, essentially, is that the Obama administration's Environmental Protection Agency for the past few years has been looking into water contamination cases in Dimock, Pennsylvania, and other places, which is probably a little bit more important just than this study, but this is kind of emblematic of how lots of these studies have gone. In Dimock, Pennsylvania, if you look at their own PowerPoint presentations that recently were written about by the Los Angeles Times, in which the journalist there, Neela Banerjee, described what was in the PowerPoint presentations, it showed that in their own, when they were talking about the study, what they were finding on the ground, the people who were in the working out of the Philadelphia office of EPA, they basically were discovering that, yes, there is a link between the process of hydraulic fracturing and methane contamination of groundwater of people in Dimock, Pennsylvania. So she obtained these documents from a source, from whistleblowers, essentially. And what she didn't do, unfortunately, I'm not sure why, but she did not post the PowerPoint presentation. So after this article came out, I wrote about it, and then I decided I'm going to try to figure out a way to see the PowerPoint presentation myself because you know, it was only on the whim of what she described rather than seeing it myself. So I, over the course of a week or so, I ended up obtaining this PowerPoint presentation and posted it. And it was actually much more, I would just say, damning than even she described in her story in the Los Angeles Times. Basically, it was very clear. There was no doubt, if you read the PowerPoint presentation, that the person who was describing the test results was saying, look, yes, there is a direct correlation between this fracking happening in Dimock, Pennsylvania, and water contamination. And that has, you know, this story has come out in terms of people actually coming out and saying their water is contaminated. Lots of citizens in Dimock, including Craig Sautner, Scott Eli, Victoria Schweitzer, and others. But, you know, above and beyond that, the EPA went out of its way not only to bring this study to the public, but also has a death statement on the record in July of 2012, basically lying to the American public about the fact that there any water that was contaminated in Dimock was naturally occurring, even though in their own documents they didn't ever release to the public. They say the opposite. And it's not a big surprise to anyone who's been following this issue closely that water's being contaminated. What is pretty grotesque, though, is that the Environmental Protection Agency is lying to the American public, and it's not the first time it's happened. That's what I wanted to highlight a little bit quickly, is that earlier this year, a similar story came out in Weatherford, Texas. A guy by the name of Steve Lipsky had his water contaminated by Range Resources, which was fracking about a mile from his house. His story is featured in Gasland, too. So, but the long story short is that the EPA had a whole investigation going, went on the ground in Weatherford, Texas, spent a lot of money to do these studies. And at the end of the day, they made a political calculus in March 2012, just months before this Dimock situation, and they shut down the investigation, shut down any studies that were going on. And so there's these studies that sort of had been sitting there for almost a year. And then in January of 2013, a story came up, the Associated Press, which showed that Jeffrey Thine, a hydrogeologist, had found that there was a correlation again between fracking and groundwater contamination, but that was not what the EPA was on the record saying. So it's a trend in which the EPA is essentially lying to the American public about what it's finding, and then therefore setting policies. And, you know, President Obama's climate action plan speech, he talked about how there's clean burning natural gas and has been a big endorser of fracking and natural gas and using industry talking points. But that's really the basis of it, is them, you know, basically coming out with what I would describe as propaganda statements about fracking itself, and that are in direct sort of conflict with what their own staff is telling. So now whistleblowers within the EPA are becoming very upset and starting to speak out, and I fear for the whistleblowers themselves right now because of what's happened with whistleblowers in national security circles, for example.
If the president were Republican and we were still tallying the impeachable offenses, I'd add this one to the list. The other very interesting, one of many very interesting posts from you about fracking involved, which I was a little bit surprised to see, was a fracking companies studying the Army's counterinsurgency manual. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so this is really interesting, especially in light of the new hire by the City University of New York's Honors College of General David Petraeus, who was a co-author of the Army Counterinsurgency Field Manual that came out sort of back in late days of the Bush administration, and when there's a switch between shock and awe and counterinsurgency, and that was sort of the transition into what is now targeted assassination by the U.S. military. But long story short here is that we'll get into Petraeus' seminar and everything he's teaching his students, which is troubling in of itself. But the industry, back in November 2011, at a conference I was actually at, a public relations conference, where all these big companies sent their PR flacks and hacks to talk about how they were going to manage the American public, they said that one of the companies, Anadarko Petroleum, their PR guy, Matt Carmichael, said that essentially he has all of his PR staff read the counterinsurgency field manual because it's a good way to portrays how to deal with angry citizenry. And basically he said, and he's on the record saying, and I'm not exaggerating, that opposition to fracking is akin to an insurgency, so that's why the counterinsurgency field manual is an important one for his staff to read. He also said that his staff should read Rumsfeld's rules, because that also talks about how to deal with an angry public. And this comes full circle with the hiring of David Petraeus, and his course is very interesting at CUNY Honors College. Basically, you know, after his whole affair with Paula Broadwell, he got a new gig both at USC, University of Southern California, and also at this Honors College in Manhattan, which is, you know, not coincidentally, I would say, one block from his other job, which is a Wall Street investor now working at Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts in Midtown Manhattan. And if you look at the course description, which I got from a Freedom of Information Act law request, it really mirrors the job that he's doing at Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts, as they describe it and as they described it to the Wall Street Journal. Not only that, but the readings themselves are very hotly disputed, and among close observers of fracking and other energy issues, basically seen as industry-funded propaganda studies, whether it's studies on natural gas exports, the Keystone XL itself, which the State Department review we'll talk about later, and another key study that was done by Obama's now Department of Energy head, Ernest Moniz, called The Future of Natural Gas, that he did when he was a professor at MIT. All of these are readings in his course, and I would say it's not a coincidence at all, not only because of the course description, but Kohlberg, Kravis, and Roberts actually owns shale gas acreage assets in Texas, and also is a partial owner of Energy Future Holdings, which is a commodities futures trading huge conglomerate, which is a dues-paying member, for example, of the American Legislative Exchange Council. So essentially, it looks like David Petraeus, the author of the Counterinsurgency Field Manual, is being sent into these small seminars to train future David Petraeuses. And I guess the way I would describe it is he's essentially inculcating them with corporate miseducation, to quote a term that Noam Chomsky uses.
We're speaking with Steve Horn, writer for DSmog blog. You use the term, Steve, fracademia, to describe the types of studies that Professor Petraeus is imposing on his students. But I just want to return briefly to the frackers studying the counterinsurgency, and here we have the military teaching the fracking propaganda. We've also actually seen private military-like troops, including in Canada, sent to guard sites, even for just inspection for planned fracking or tar sands operations. And you have another couple of articles you published about a private company called Stratfor that I think if for all of the people that I go and talk to and they express all their frustration and activism doesn't do any good, and I try to explain to them how seriously the government takes activism even when they pretend to be ignoring us, this is like exhibit number one for how seriously a corporation takes public nonviolent activism. Can you just describe briefly what you found?
Sure, yeah. So Stratfor is shorthand for Strategic Forecasting, Inc., which has been around for a really long time but didn't really get on the map of most people until WikiLeaks gained what they call the global intelligence files from Jeremy Hammond's hack of Stratfor. And Jeremy Hammond is now going to serve 20 years in prison for doing it. But, you know, in this story that I worked on, a two-part series, I looked at not only current files that now WikiLeaks has on their website, but also the history of Stratfor. And before they were Stratfor, they were a firm. I think the most important point that I want to talk about briefly is that they were a firm by the name of Mongovan, Bisco, and Duchin. And just to show how seriously they do take activism and how much effort they put into mapping it all out and thinking about how it works. And this is a firm that all of its clientele is huge multinational corporations. They really went so far as to create a four-step formula of how to defeat grassroots activism. And the steps that they created were kind of creating subgroups of activists. And one of the subgroups is what they described as the opportunists, people who, they're politically active, but their motivation for getting into activism is just to be close to power. So that's the opportunists. Then there's the realists, who are sort of in between. You know, they look for maybe some peace, healing, reform, but they're willing to concede a lot to the powerful corporations and such. And I think the two most interesting camps are idealists and realists, which Ron Duchin, again, the once owner, co-owner of Mongovan, Bisco, and Duchin, and also a former co-owner of Stratfor before he passed away in 2010, I believe. He said that, these two camps are the most pivotal because, the radicals and then the idealists. The radicals will never, ever concede any ground, and they're almost hopeless, but probably from our point of view, maybe the most important activists. And then the idealists are the ones that he's looking to sway towards being realists. So when you look at corporate PR, trying to sway towards conceding to policies and such that are probably not just in terms of like what someone who's looking to change society is looking for. But I think a long story short of Stratfor and what was once known as Mongovan, Bisco, and Duchin, and also once known as Pagan International, is that these corporations are really well organized, first of all. But second of all, they really do take grassroots activists very seriously. And these firms rose up because of grassroots activists as a reaction to what grassroots activists were doing. So I think it's an exhibit A, really, of how important organizing is, because it really does scare both the people in politically powerful positions and also corporations. And I think that if you read these two parts, it becomes very clear just how organized they are, but also just how much they fear opposition to what they're doing.
One of the reports that you write about Professor David Petraeus using in his Fracademia lectures was a report that was produced by a company hired by the State Department to produce a report on the tar sands pipeline, and you looked into some background on that company. Can you talk about that investigation as well?
Sure. And so the Petraeus thing is interesting. I'll just note that briefly, is that this study of the Keystone XL pipeline that was done by a firm by the name of Environmental Resources Management, Inc., the State Department contracted out to do the environmental review for this controversial pipeline. That's the premise of his seminar, that he had one of his grad students as a non-resident fellow at Harvard. He had a grad student write up a survey to start off the course that all the students will read. And the basis of the course is essentially that because the State Department said that there's not very much environmental problems with the Keystone XL, then that it should be approved. But that's huge, basically a huge error in looking at what this review was and not explaining who did it and who they were. So that's I think it's the most interesting part, because it goes right into the corporate miseducation sphere again. But going to the ERM review itself, ERM is a group that has been described by Platform London, which is a British NGO, as part of the carbon web, or sort of a web of sphere of influence in which they put out all of these types of studies like they did for the Keystone XL and many other things that I've documented, such as Delaware City refinery of fracked oil and tar sands. And then a Peruvian LNG project where there's a pipeline that's going to be set up to export gas to the global market, and in the Caspian Sea, another pipeline, and then many other examples in which ERM Group is hired by Big Oil to say that projects are either socially sound, environmentally sound, or both. And they've historically, I can't think of a case that I've looked into where ERM didn't say that something was not safe. I challenged someone to find a project they didn't say was safe. But that's who, the way that the bureaucracy works in the State Department is that the State Department did not even actually hire this contractor. They leave it up to the company that's doing the project to hire a reviewer for the environmental review. And so TransCanada itself chose ERM Group just to kind of show some of the dysfunctionality of how Washington, D.C. works, and how the White House bureaucracies work, is that the White House and State Department didn't even choose this contractor, but that's the contractor that now has a State Department logo on it that they did, that says that the Keystone XL pipeline is going to be safe and sound, which flies in the face of the evidence of so many scientists who aren't bought off and sold by the industry, and also just ongoing evidence of the actual Keystone pipeline, because Keystone XL is known as the extension line. There's a Keystone pipeline that was approved by the Bush administration in March 2008, and that one has already spilled 12 times. Keystone XL, which the southern half was approved by Obama in March 2012 via an executive order, that one already, people have gone in the pipelines from the tar sands blockade and seen that there's holes in the pipeline already in terms of how it was welded, and they're already going, Michaels Corporation, the contractor for Keystone XL, has already gone down to the site in Texas because there's anomalies in the way the pipeline's being built and the welding. So long story short, ERM's review of the pipeline is very suspect, and even more troubling is the fact that it's now being taught in classrooms, especially in David Petraeus' classroom, as a legitimate study and as promises. Course.
This company, ERM, that did this report, you wrote about their history of producing highly questionable reports, including one on a refinery in Delaware. Can you talk a little bit more about their record?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mentioned very briefly before that they have a record. Not only, the Delaware story is interesting because right now in Delaware, the Delaware City Refining Company owns a refinery which is getting fracked oil from the Bakken Shale and tar sands and refining it via freight rail that's owned by Norfolk Southern. And although independent studies have shown that there's high levels of benzene in the air, which is a carcinogen, high levels of many other carcinogens in the air that are way above EPA recommended levels. ERM Group, in reaction to this study, which came out in May 2013, three weeks later came out with their own study saying that since the refinery was reopened in 2011, not only is the air safe and sound, but it's actually gotten cleaner since the refinery was there. But you have to question why they said that, and it's a pretty simple answer. It's because the refiner itself, Delaware City Refining Company, funded that study, and that's kind of how ERM operates in general. They do these studies that are funded by the company that's looking to have a project in a certain place. So that's a parallel to what happened in Peru with the Peru LNG pipeline project, which has been disastrous in terms of what it's been doing to the Amazon forest and to the people in Peru. And actually, the Peruvian government recently came out and said that they rejected ERM's findings, so now that was a big step backwards for big oil in terms of what they wanted to do in Peru. But, you know, they've also done the same thing in the Caspian Sea for this huge export pipeline called the Baku-Tehan-TBC-Li pipeline, in which, gas from the Caspian Sea is going to be exported to the global market through to Turkey. So, all in all, ERM has this record, and in that one, there was a big pipeline explosion in the Caspian Sea that was almost the same size as the, by BP, of the kind of a similar size spill as the BP oil spill that we know of in the United States that Greg Palast has written about. So long story short, ERM Group has a history of saying that certain things are clean and green and socially sound, and whatever study they happen to be doing, they tend to rubber stamp, say that things are going to be okay, but then the way it plays out is it never happens that way. So that's the troubling premise at the heart of the State Department's review of the pipeline right now, the Keystone XL pipeline, and that's why this particular study has been so controversial and highly contested. And I think that it'll be interesting to see if activists can keep pushing on that to keep delegitimizing the study and push for a new one, and or, you know, as a way of stopping the pipeline from being built.
As I understand it, even if ERM had a clean record, it's full of ties to profiteers from on fossil fuels, and doesn't appear even at first glance to be a legitimate, impartial investigatory company. There in fact was a protest after this news was became known at ERM in Washington, and 54 people went to jail, and then the State Department announced they were going to review their review process. But nobody seems to be taking that too seriously. And there's at the time that we're speaking, there's a protest planned at the State Department itself. What do you know about these latest developments?
Yeah, so the latest development is semi-important, but what the State Department really said is that they're doing not a full investigation. And it's not the State Department, it's the Office of Inspector General of the State Department, but they're doing an inquiry into how this firm was chosen. An investigation would mean deploying all their legal resources to figuring out and maybe prosecuting or doing some sort of legal measure. Right now it's just an inquiry, which means they're just kind of doing a surface level investigation. And really, to me, that's a little suspect, just because there's plenty of evidence out there from what journalists and groups like Friends of the Earth and others like that have been doing, that have already shown that, look, this group lied on their conflict of interest form, except that they don't have any pre-existing relationship with TransCanada. When they do right now in Alaska, they did something similar with that gas pipeline project. So they lied, they knowingly lied, and that's actually a federal crime, False Claims Act, but that would be a real investigation, actually prosecuting this corporation for lying on a federal contract, but I don't foresee that happening. And the ERM protest was important because it put them on the map. I think even more important is potentially what's coming up is a sit-in at the State Department, which I think ERM will be roped into. I think being led by Credo, Mobil, and others on basically just pointing out all of the errors of what's been happening in the past couple of years with the Keystone XL pipeline, and hopefully staving off the northern half. Unfortunately, activists weren't able to stave off the southern half of that pipeline that runs from Cushing, Oklahoma, down to Texas, which is going to feed 700,000 barrels a day of tar sands down to the Gulf Coast refineries. that was approved by an Obama executive order in March 2012. But I think for the ecosystem's sake, it's still worth what the struggle is left for this northern half, which still cuts across a huge portion of the country and clearly is very important to TransCanada based on all of the money and lobbying resources and PR resources they poured into making it happen.
You know, there was a hotly contested, unpopular proposal for a highway near where I live in Virginia, and the state and the county went ahead and built half of it and dead-ended into nowhere, and then eventually built the other half. To what extent is this southern half of a pipeline waiting on the northern half? I mean, to what extent is the decision yet to be made that there's going to be this pipeline?
Yeah, well, I don't think that the southern half is dependent, which is, you can look at this two ways. I look at it actually in a very, it's not a good thing that it's not dependent on the northern half. The southern half will, they're going to be getting oil, not from the northern half of the pipeline, which doesn't exist right now, but they will be getting the tar sands oil from other pipelines which feed into Cushing, Oklahoma, where there is a glut of oil right now in what's known as the pipeline crossroads of the world. So, for example, through my state in Wisconsin, there's something known as the Enbridge Alberta Clipper Pipeline, which was approved by the Obama administration, I think in June 2009. That one itself feeds over 400,000 barrels a day of tar sands through Wisconsin down eventually to Cushing, Oklahoma. So then there's the Keystone Pipeline, which was approved by the Bush administration in March 2008. So those two alone are, picking up the slack of what doesn't already exist, Keystone XL pipeline, in terms of feeding oil to Cushing, and then it will be brought down to the Gulf Coast refinery. So I don't think that the southern half is dependent on the northern half in terms of how the industry sees it. Who does see it as important is TransCanada, which, stands to gain a lot of money from having this pipeline infrastructure in place from investors and such. But on the whole, for the industry, it was just very important to have the southern half of the pipeline, which I think is why the Obama administration went out of its way to give it an executive order in March 2012 during election year to have expedited building of the pipeline. And by the end of the year, that one will be sending 700,000 barrels of tar sands oil down to the Gulf Coast. I fear that the environmental community, just to kind of sum this up, is although the Keystone XL northern half is important, I think that they're really paying a lot of attention to that northern half of the pipeline at the expense of a lot of other pipeline infrastructure that's being talked about and built at the same time that doesn't necessarily go across the border, so it hasn't been getting as much attention. So for an example, Enbridge is planning the Flanagan South Pipeline, which will run from Illinois down to Missouri, down to Cushing, down to the Gulf Coast. That doesn't cross any international borders, so the State Department doesn't have to deal with it, and it kind of can fly under the radar, but do the same thing. So there's so many ways the industry is mobilized to move the oil. And at the end of the day, the only one who will be really angry if the Keystone XL northern half is not built will be TransCanada. But other companies will pick up the slack and then some based on what I've looked into.
Important information from Steve Horn, who has been our guest on Talk Nation Radio. He is a Madison, Wisconsin-based writer for DSmog Blog, contributing editor to Counterpunch, and a contributing writer at Mint Press News. Steve Horn, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.